Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Political Football, the podcast that digs into the global political stories behind the sport. I'm Jason Cowley, editor of The New Statesman.
And I'm Stephen Bush, special correspondent of The New Statesman. This is a special series focusing on the World Cup, which delves into the politics behind football.
And we're joined today once again by our regular guest, John Bew, Professor of History at King's London, Professor of Football, Professor of Foreign Policy, and a Professor of many other things. Welcome, Professor. I'll start, well, this is, of course, on the eve of the World Cup semi-finals. Astonishingly, England are in the World Cup semi-final. It's the day after Boris Johnson resigned. The British government seems to be in chaos, Stephen, and we'll touch on that in a moment. But let's start with the England game, and then we'll talk about a little bit about Croatia, and we should then talk about France, Belgium. We're talking about English nationalism, English patriotism, and whatever else. So, John Bew, how are you feeling about the semi-finals?
Well, I think the English look strong. They've yet to be tested in a way that they were in the last Euros, which they struggled to come back from mortal wounds. And they haven't actually seen any sort of... they've always led in the games they won, notwithstanding the Belgian game, which was a kind of a weird suspended animation, I think, a kind of not a dress rehearsal for a potential final. It was an odd game. So the English haven't been fully tested in that respect. You say the first game, they had to come, get those late goals to win the game. So yet to see what they're made of. But I also think on the more positive side than that, you can say the English team actually has another gear to step up to. And I think you've seen that in a couple of the key games. I think Sterling's got a goal in him and I would keep him on the pitch. I think Kane's got more from open play, potentially. He's been a very effective hold-up player, a great captain during the tournament. But I think there's more in them. So I'm really intrigued to say. I think they should have more than Croatia by the semi-finals, but my concern for them is that in the central midfield, where they only have essentially one conventional central midfielder in Jordan Henderson, they've designed a team around the assumption they will have more of the ball, and therefore wanting to maintain attacking threat, having Lingard and Dele Alli along with them. I think Rakitic and Modric will control the pace of the game, being the Barcelona. And
Modric will sit deep, won't he? And sort of like almost like a American-style quarterback dictating the rhythm of the game.
He'll take the ball from the centre-backs and play it around the pitch. And he has had more touches in most of the games he's played than nearly every other player. Rakitic is also unbelievably effective at playing in tight spaces in a way that might make Jordan Henderson look a little bit clunky. And I think England's natural high press game that's worked quite well may come up against two people who are supremely confident on the ball and can play out of tight places. So I think it'd be a different type of game. I still think overall English have the firepower. If you think of Harry Kane on Lovren, Dejan Lovren, for example, most cases in domestic games, in Spurs-Liverpool games, he gives them a hell of a time. So I am
Lovren
really intrigued.
Lovren was destroyed at a Spurs-Liverpool game, wasn't he? And Klopp pulled him off. Do you remember he was humiliated against Spurs?
Exactly. He went at half time, I think.
Pulled him off even before half time. Stephen, have you been impressed by England?
Yes, I have. I mean, I think, obviously player for player, England, I think, are the weakest of the four remaining teams. On the other hand, of course, football is coming home. and it will, as John says, be a very different challenge for England because I think it will be a game in which they have less of the ball. I think that will be the first time this tournament, actually, I think the first time in qualifying as well, that Southgate side has had to have significantly less of the ball. However, Croatia, for all their brilliance, have occasionally turned in some bizarre stinkers and have been very weak at set pieces, which, of course, is one of the things this England side has been very strong at. So I think it will be a very easy on the eye game, even if it is one with a disappointing result.
And you've been a big defender of Raheem Sterling, and you know, he has a poor goal scoring record for England. I think he's only ever scored two in more than 40 appearances. But you've liked his commitment, his energy, his movement.
Yeah, his movement off the ball, his pace. He creates. If you look at most of England's chances and goals, he is involved either in the build up or the finishing. The problem, in the build up or in the direct assist. The problem is his finishing has not been great. I'm not sure if that
is that confidence. Do you think?
My instinct is if he'd got a goal late on against Panama, then maybe he would be scoring sort of freely with each time. Because I thought against Sweden, that great almost goal he created with his pace, where he fluffed the finish, and then it felt that every other time he had the ball in a one-on-one, it was almost as if you could hear him thinking, got to bury this. But I think he will become over the coming years a great finisher as well. He is a wonderful kind of player playing as our 10, and he is, I think, vital to the way England play and to how it creates chance, how we create chances. I do wonder if Southgate might, seeing as we will have less of the ball, opt to sacrifice one of Lingard or Sterling from the starting 11 to have Dyer and Henderson as a double pivot. But to try and
take on Rakitic and Modric in midfield. John, I don't think, Croatia, they look very good against Argentina when they thrashed the demoralised Argentinian side. But the last two games have gone to extra times and then penalties. Their forwards in particular have looked very heavy-legged. They're okay at the back, have a good goalkeeper, outstanding in midfield. I don't see a lot up front to worry us.
Yeah, I mean, so they're a bit dependent on Mandzukic, who's
a fading
in his early 30s. Yeah. He leads the line extremely effectively.
He was very good at Bayern Munich, and then he was replaced by Lewandowski. He went to Atletico Madrid. Where is he now?
He's also Juventus, yeah. So, he has pedigree to him, and there's actually some talk at the start of the, just before the World Cup, of him possibly coming to Manchester United as a kind of backup for Lukaku as well. He's a difficult international player to play against. He reminds me of Kuller, the Czech forward, yeah. That big, strong Czech Republic forward from a couple of years ago. And players play around him, but they have sort of been a little bit toothless.
They have Perisic, don't they? Plays more wide on the left. Highly technical player.
Yeah, conventional wing back. Again, someone that Mourinho liked very much. So, good technique, good consistent balls in the box from Perisic. Not a lot of chances, but again, how many chances have England created in open play? We talk about Raheem Sterling. He's created chances for himself. I completely agree with Stephen.
Lingard has chances in the first game. What I've liked about this Southgate side is the structure of the team. By which I mean they have a system and they stick to it. And one thinks of the chaos of late Roy Hodgson when he was just throwing on strikers and there was no formal structure to the team. But also set pieces. I mean, England look very... They remind me a little bit of George Graham's Arsenal at set pieces. They look extremely dangerous from set pieces where they line up in that sort of line of four and then spin into different positions. And Trippier's delivery has been terrific. And actually so has... Ashley Young's from corners and free kicks.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big feature of it. People can talk about the sophistication that Southgate has brought to the game. Actually, Roy Hodgson tried this sort of high press 4-3-3 in the last tournament, and it looked like it might work initially, and of course didn't work, and they fell down upon themselves. I mean, actually, a conventional England team, the way that Harry Kane's held up the ball, basically grinding himself into corners, pushing off centre-backs in the last game in particular. Heroic, really impressive, but it's not some sort of fluid, modern version of football. The fact that Harry Maguire is so big and strong and good in the air, therefore creates space for John Stones, etc., etc. In some ways, you could say it's a throwback to the thing that one would associate with English football.
Although they're at least attempting to pass it out of defence. Stones and Maguire, they're carrying out of defence. And they're not just hitting it long, Stephen Arley, as we have seen in the past from England, or indeed losing the ball very easily.
Well, I think that to me, the moment when I kind of, and obviously I started this tournament in quite a pessimistic place about England's chances, the moment when I thought, oh, actually, I think this team is going to surprise me, and it obviously has because it's in the final four, was 1-1 against Tunisia with 10 minutes to go. They didn't start hitting it long. They continued to stick to their system. the heartening thing against Sweden, where Sweden did a very good job, I thought that was actually, from a tactical perspective, it was a wonderful game to watch at first, because they obviously played very high, prevented Pickford from playing out of the box, and England did then find a way around not being able to play in their usual fashion, which does give me hope that against Croatia, when they have a different challenge of not having the ball, they will similarly find a way to adapt.
On that one, on the adaptability of the England team, I think Southgate will stick with the same team, and I can understand why. The way that Damien Dier came on in the Colombia game, partly because of the high intensity of the game, I actually slowed it down a little bit, and I wonder how many successful changes Southgate has made over the course of the tournament. Rashford in the first game, I think, you know, an injection of pace. Vardy also has been quite effective coming off the bench.
Bringing Rashford on in extra time against the Colombians so that he could take a penalty was a decent move.
That was a decent move, but I think they were treading water in extra time. He played Rashford as an eight. Dyer started playing the ball back to a rather tired Walker and Stones. So just in terms of adapting to Croatia having a lot of the ball, I don't know if there's a huge amount in terms of the options on the bench. It does depend on, I think, primarily on Eric Dyer. I don't know if I can see Eric Dyer getting that close to Rakitic and Modric as well. So that's another kind of open question for English if they don't score from a corner or a free kick.
Now, Southgate, rightly so, is being admired for his calm, his humility, his articulacy, different kind of language around the team. Are we overrating him, Stephen, or was it that our expectations were so low, we're surprised when we encounter an England manager who isn't, say, Sam Allardyce?
I mean, I think it's not just an expectations were low. I know I complained about this a bit, but one of the things he has brought is an understanding that things aren't based on sort of luck, right? You know, penalty shootouts are not a lottery, right? They are a test of a footballer's technical ability. The way they prepared for it is they did it right at the end of training when they would all be tired, which of course is just, and kind of tried to get them into a place where, look, and now you need to do the thing you've done in training. And with the exception of Henderson's penalty, they were all penalties taken at a high technical level. Now, obviously, international football is different from the club game, so we don't have an idea of what he would do if he was in charge of transfers or any of that. But I think he has shown himself to be a very skilled manager at a technical level, not least through the way he's protected his players and the fact they didn't freeze against Sweden, faced with a challenge to how they set up tactically, faced with a game in which they were favourites, faced with a game with a very open thing. So, yeah, I think Southgate does deserve all of the plaudits he's getting.
And John, last week in the New Statesman, I wrote a cover piece about England, English nationalism, patriotism, the English nation, the English football team, how the World Cup and Southgate's young, diverse team reawakened a sense of progressive English nationalism. And I've had a good response to the piece. Do you see some of these forces in play during this World Cup?
I think we discussed it in one of the previous episodes. The fact that the England players were singing the national anthem was a kind of interesting thing. And it turns out it has transpired subsequently that, you know, Southgate did have a word with them, asked them why they didn't sing it. And you know, most of them, you know, some of them didn't know the words, etc. So it does tell you something about it. I think the pressure is slightly off in this tournament and expectations always go up. But, you know, if you really think back to the appointment of Southgate, it was kind of exasperation after the Allardyce incident. That in itself was a bit of a nod to, you know, a sort of overbearing, pragmatic approach to football based on the fact that, you know, you've tried all these different things with Hodgson, Capello, and Sven-Goran Eriksson, nothing's worked, give up on it. So I don't think there's a master plan here. I mean, he's gone up in my estimation, but England really should have won all the games they played, apart from the Belgian game.
What about the forces this World Cup summer has unlocked or unleashed? Do you see something optimistic about Englishness, a possible awakening or reawakening or redefinition of Englishness?
I'm really optimistic about all those things in general. I wouldn't overplay the World Cup on this. Actually, you know, even people talk about the Brexit referendum, you know, I think it's actually remarkably genteel by international standards, notwithstanding, you know, some issues with it. I'm not sure the English football team has transformed that in any significant way. But, you know,
but you're a Northern Irishman, but you're also British. Do you understand the tensions between Englishness and Britishness, a sense of English nationalism rising because of Scottish nationalism?
Yeah, you know, I think actually this England team is more likeable for those on the Celtic fringes. I think if you have a kind of Lampard, Beckham, you know,
Terry,
big club team, that, you know, the Scots in particular, sort of, you know, I mean, I doubt that, you know, in Glasgow, there's everyone will have their Croatia football kits on, but I don't think it's the same sort of sense of hostility. It is more of a likeable team. They're less, you know, cocksure, self-confident. They're less symbols of kind of Premier League dynasties. You know, there's a couple of exceptions like Sterling's at City, etc. So, but, you know, Harry Kane plays for Tottenham Hotspur.
Yeah, but also, Stephen, a lot of these players have either been at smaller clubs and have worked their way up to bigger clubs, or they were at bigger clubs and couldn't get a game and therefore went out on loan. Kane was at, what, Leicester, Norwich, Millwall, Trippier, Pickford was always being sent out on loan. Maguire was at Hull City, Delph was at Leeds, you know, once great club, but no longer. Has that played a part, do you think?
No, I think it probably plays a part in their essential likability, in that they don't have that kind of... They aren't a generation of players who've been told since they were 15 in the academy that they were going to be great stars. I think it's interesting how the England player of that cohort, who in many ways as a raw talent ought to be England's greatest central midfielder, but seems to have decided to take the money and go to West Ham rather than try and strike a new career for himself at AC Milan somewhere, is Jack Wilshere, right? The only one of this set of England players who did come in with a kind of sense of his greatness in the academy. You know, even Lingard, a hugely technically accomplished player because of his height, did have to kind of fight his way up through the United Academy. I mean, I think the thing about kind of a renaissance of or for progressive Englishness is, I think the thing about the success of the England team is because it is unifying and it gives everyone something to cheer about, it creates space for a more sort of left-wing national revival, because obviously the right does best when it can sharply narrow down what Englishness or Britishness is, you know, to define it as only leavers or only, you know, hardworking families or et cetera, et cetera. Because when everyone cheers for the England team and the England team is doing well, it then I think creates space for the left to do, you know, some of the quite opportunistic and clever retail policies that Labour has been doing, so them re-announcing their bank holiday policy essentially every time England advances in a tournament, which is a good way of them subtly kind of putting their hands up and going, we're here and we're vaguely into the nation. But I think mainly, of course, it is about giving something everyone to cheer for, which of course is the interesting thing about Croatia, who of course were not a nation the last time England were in a semi-final. Their first president famously said that sport along with war was the thing which most distinguished a nation. And it's also how Croatia's success, you know, they like England. Yeah, the fascinating thing about this side of the bracket is you have two semi-finalists who have outperformed expectations at home. However, you have a Croatia side who will be sitting there going, this is our last chance. And although I suspect this will be the easiest route on paper than this generation of England players ever faced to a final, they will be better in the next, you know, they can also expect to be a better team in coming tournaments. Whereas Croatia, I think, will have more, yeah, we'll know this is the last chance for that set of players.
Because Modric is in the great Modric, one of my favourite players, he's in his 30s.
32.
Interesting comment about Stephen made about Croatian nationalism, and very much the football team has always been a great symbol of the new Croatian nation that emerged out of the ruins of Yugoslavia and the brutal and bitter Balkan Wars. There was a famous match, I think, in 1994 when the newly independent Croatia, the Croatian football team, went to Italy, and Italy had lost in the World Cup final and were a very good Italian side. And Croatia arrived in Palermo, I think it was, led by Suka and Boksic and Boban, you know, that fantastic generation of players. And they destroyed Italy. It was a famous victory. And Croatia looked back on this as a key moment in their independence as a nation and as a football team. And I remember the Italian manager at the same time saying they thought they were not only taking on a football team, they were taking on a whole people. So Croatia are very dangerous opponents for many reasons for England.
Yeah, I completely agree. And if you think of that Suka, who's been very nice about the England team, by the way, and particularly about Jesse Lingard and a couple of players, and he's in sort of you know, he's such an effective technical striker. And a lot of them played in Italy as well. That's the Croatian generation.
Osuka played. Did he not play for both Real Madrid and Barcelona?
Yeah.
And very fleetingly, Arsenal.
And Boban was at AC Milan. And yeah, I mean, so actually, that's why I think the idea that this is the golden generation that you know, may not do it again is potentially problematic. I think the point of it, the distinguishing characteristic of those Croatia teams is unbelievable technical ability in an age of running very fast, you know, and being more fit than the other team seems to be sort of preeminent. So I think they're a really dangerous opponent. I think winning two penalty shootouts, sort of dragging yourself through those games, notwithstanding the fact they survived the last, the last gas Russian equaliser as well. I would be deeply concerned. They are the hardest team that England have faced, and I think they're a better team than the Belgian B side that England got beaten by.
Although that was England B as well.
But I think they're a really tough opponent. You're not at the stage of the World Cup where you have to beat some serious teams, and I think, you know.
But that is good, isn't it? You don't want to come home from the World Cup just being told you were lucky. You want, if England is to win this tournament, they now have to beat an exceptionally gifted Croatian side and then one of Belgium and France.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Now, you're both with me here. Stephen, if at the beginning of the tournament you tipped the French, although last week I think it was, you then switched to Croatia. John tipped the French from the beginning. Our other guest, Ali McGovern, tipped Belgium, still in the tournament. David Winner's Spain went. I can now reveal my tip was very predictably Brazil, and they've gone, so I'm out. France, John, have you been impressed?
I also think, as to what I said about England, France definitely have another gear in terms of the strengths of their bench. The fact that, you know, Griezmann's been sort of buzzing around the edges, he hasn't quite exploded into action. Pogba, I think he's been a really good World Cup so far. And if you have Kanté beside him, he's liberated in the way he plays for France, in a way he sadly, as a Manchester United fan, I haven't seen yet. I think the French are really good. They have Rafa Varane at the back. I think Lloris is a wonderful goalkeeper. I still think they're the toughest. I think they're a better team than Belgium. I think they'll beat Belgium, and I think they're the hardest team to play against. They're not dependent on any sort of old players. They have a system where they can play Olivier Giroud up front, who may not be the best technically, but he works for that French team. They know what they're about. They know their identity, and I say that I think, you know, to my mind, they're still by far and away the strongest team.
And they have fantastic options from the bench, you know, someone like Dembele, who's now at Barcelona, can come on and transform a game. Stephen, are you going to switch back to France?
I mean, I half want to, but I also feel, having switched once, I should stick with Croatia. I think so. France are definitely player for player, and in terms of their, you know, their quality, are the best team. I think the nice thing about this World Cup is there is no longer a team that I would be upset to see lift it. Although, because of France's quality, in some ways, it would be almost, they're the only aristocrat left in the tournament, ironically, considering France's history. But so it'll be a disappointment in an odd way for such a great team, for a sort of a big team to win it after the kind of wonderful topsy-turvy tournament. But I do think Belgium, for all their quality, against Brazil, Hazard's selfishness and led to so many counters when he had opportunities to pass it easily for a third goal. And I think then against France, they will probably be punished for their slightly odd lopsidedness and their coaching deficiencies.
Martinez, Stephen, who we criticised in one of the earlier programmes, you know, obviously believes in himself as a kind of tactical genius. I mean, he has a high self-regard, which alienated a lot of the Everton players when he was there. But that tactical switch against Brazil, and I've seen him do it before once against Arsenal, when he played Lukaku sort of wide right. In this instance, he played Hazard wide left, and the brilliant Kevin De Bruyne was almost like a false nine or attacking from advanced positions in midfield. Did you admire what Martinez pulled off against what, actually, let's be honest, not a great Brazilian team?
Yeah, I mean, I think with the exception perhaps of Fernandinho, I actually thought this was an all right Brazilian side. But he is very good at mid-game tweaks. The problem is often with Martinez is the reason why he gets to demonstrate that he's good at mid-game tweaks is he's not that great at setting up a team at minute zero and against a team of the quality of France, right? So Japan is a great example, right? That he made some good mid-game tweaks in that game. But ultimately, if France race into a two-goal lead of that type, I do not think France are going to lose 3-2 at the death from a brilliant bit of a kind of almost non-assist assist from Lukaku. I think that as my moment of the tournament, just the brilliance of him not touching the ball there that moment. I've watched it several times. It's just such a, and he's going so fast and he has to decide so quickly not to touch it. Lukaku, I think, fits in with a kind of wider pattern of this tournament. Pogba, of course, is another of United players flourishing away from the kind of controlling shackles of Mourinho and his ultra-defensive approach to football.
John, you were also very critical of Martinez. I mean, apart from the Spain-Portugal 3-3, which I think was the second day of the tournament, Belgium would have been involved in two of my favourite games, the brilliant 2-3 match against Japan that Stephen just mentioned, and of course the victory against Brazil. I mean, can they?
Yeah, they have momentum. They've got a bit of a story. I mean, he has had to change the team with like breaking the structure thereof. The one we haven't mentioned who was pretty dangerous against Brazil was Fellaini.
Another Manchester United.
But again, Mourinho's ultimate blunt instrument, which, you know, Martinez has not been afraid to use. And there's plenty of people who thought Nangalan should have gone in the World Cup squad ahead of Fellaini. So I give him credit for not being such a purist that he doesn't use a very effective blunt instrument. Yeah, I think Belgium can do it. De Bruyne has the bit between his teeth gliding across the pitch. He's been really effective. I think if France scores first, I think that's very... I mean, Belgium, of course, have made that wonderful comeback against Japan. I just think the French are extremely dangerous when they have a lead and the threat of Mbappe and the pace they have is what could upset them. But absolutely, Belgium could do it. But here's my question, you know, back to you both. Who do you rather play in the final, presuming England beats Croatia? Would it be France or Belgium?
I think I'd rather face Belgium, Stephen.
Well, France are the best team in the tournament. So from a kind of winning perspective, you'd rather not face the best team in the tournament. But I think if England are going to win the World Cup, it would be wonderful to knock out one of the tournament's true great, right? In the same way, Italy in 2006, I think quite similar to this England team, not the best team in the tournament on paper. Yes, they had a fortunate draw, but they took every chance they were given and they were deserved winners of that.
And they beat the German side in that famous semi-final in Dortmund, 2-0.
And they beat a very strong France side with Henri at the peak of his powers, Zidane at the end of his career, but still an amazing footballer. And they beat them on penalties. And I think, in terms of who I would rather England face in the final, I would rather beat the best.
These are heady times watching England. John, do you think it's the hot weather, the optimism of the World Cup? Because politically, it's dark, isn't it, here?
It's crazy times, right? let's see what happens if England wins the World Cup. Yeah, I mean, it's always very exciting when England do well in the World Cup. There's something quite of a nice mood, notwithstanding the occasional throwing of plastic chairs and the invasion of IKEA, which we can kind of turn a blind eye to. In another context, could have gone, you know, rather ugly. I mean, domestically, we are in interesting times across the piece. I don't know if it's dark times. I think things have actually gone, I was saying to Stephen before we started, quite glacially, even by the standards of the last couple of years, and we've moved a few obelisks around from place to place.
I think I was thinking of dark times because of the arrival on Thursday of the absurd figure of Donald Trump in Britain.
Of course, as well. Yeah, yeah.
The wider, the sort of deeper geopolitical scene. But we won't. Let's not get gloomy. Let's not bring Trump into our podcast. Stephen, what about Russia? At the start of the tournament, there were great anxieties about having this great tournament in an authoritarian state. How Putin might use it. Is the skill of Putin, rather than to have turned it into a kind of grotesque display of propaganda and Russian nationalism, is to have made Russia appear like a normal country?
Yeah, I mean, he had, as you kind of expect with any managed democracy, they have managed to put a good show on if they've had some protests about pensions away from World Cup cities and have not been the subject of the level of repression that one would usually expect. Yeah, I mean, to reiterate my feelings on it on the start of the tournament, I think, you know, Russia are a great footballing nation. I am a lot more relaxed about Russia hosting this tournament than I mean, people have lost their lives because of the decision to allow Qatar to host the 2022 World Cup. And I think that
you mean the construction workers.
Yeah. I think that's a much more grim tournament. And of course, it is always good for the tournament if the host country does well. That is not the only reason why 2010 was not a very good World Cup, but it contributed to 2010 being a disappointing World Cup. It made 2014 more fun than Brazil went quite far, but also there. Disintegration was quite amusing. And it has been good than Russia have got so far, even though it is, of course, slightly remarkable than the worst ranked team in the tournament. 36-year-old strikers have been playing with quite such ability.
Their running stats are very good.
Extraordinary energy. Let's perhaps not go there, but I understand the implication. John, it's been a wonderful World Cup, hasn't it?
It's been the best World Cup I can remember. And I think in our first podcast, I talked about 1990 being a bit starry-eyed about that. But actually, people said it was quite a defensive World Cup, quite sort of tactically dull. And even I remember Scalacci scoring these great goals, but that was not an exciting Italy team. I think it's been the best World Cup in my lifetime, mainly, first of all, because of the football. Secondly, because of the stadia. Actually, they've been excellent. And, you know, I don't think that reflects anything on Putin or Putin's Russia. I don't think he can take credit for it. Actually, he hasn't been around that much.
No. The Russian coach said he was receiving phone calls from him before each game and then after each game. But he hasn't been. I think he was there for the first game against the Saudis. But it has been clearly well organised. The atmosphere inside the stadiums is good. There's been no hooliganism. As far as I know from London, there's been no overt racism that many of us feared. A lot of England fans stayed away because they were fearful that they were going to get beaten up. The football's been open, exciting. Obviously, England have had a good run to the semi-finals. But so there are good teams left in the tournament. Dare I ask for your prediction, Stephen, for the semi-finals? Do you want to have a go?
I think it will be France-Croatia in the final. It will be a repeat of the 1998 semi-final.
It'll be France, England, and then anything Tibet in the final.
Yeah, I think it'll be England-France final. And this is the penultimate World Cup podcast, but we will return once the final's been played. So we'll do the next podcast on a Monday. John will be back, but we're going to get Helen Thompson in from Talking Politics, which is a podcast we like very much. And we'll see where we are next week. Thank you again to my co-presenter, Stephen Bush, and thank you to our special guest, John Bew. You've been listening to Political Football, and I'm Jason Cowley, editor of The New Statesman. Thanks for listening to Political Football. We'll be back next week with another episode.
In the meantime, you can send us your questions and comments for future episodes via Twitter. I'm on at StephenKB, and Jason is at JasonCowleyNS.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.